Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Can you be a good feminist and a good Christian? We'll ask that question and others about feminism and spirituality today on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest is Sister Joan Chittister. The Catholic nun is a member of the Benedictine Sisters of Erie. She is a social psychologist, teacher, and lecturer. She holds a doctorate in speech communication theory from Penn State University and is the founder and director of Bennett Vision, a resource and research center for contemporary spirituality. She's the author of many books, including Heart of Flesh, A Feminist Spirituality for Women and Men. Sister Joan will be in Champaign-Urbana 1 week from Saturday to take part in a Baker Board event at the Wesley Foundation. The board's programs are open to all. In 1965, Methodist Bishop James Baker established an endowment in honor of his wife and daughter. The Baker Memorial Fund is intended to expand the ministry of the Wesley Foundation to speak to the needs of women. A little later in the program, I'll have more information about Sister Joan's visit to Champaign-Urbana on November 6th. Meantime, do join our discussion with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Sister Joan, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello, Celeste. It's nice to be with you. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, it's an honor to talk with you this afternoon. Reading Heart of Flesh, I was really struck by an anecdote, one of the anecdotes you tell about your desire to become an altar boy. And I thought maybe you'd tell us that story this afternoon.
Oh, I will indeed. I mean, it's funny how, you know, when you sit and talk to people about the great ideas of life, if you talk long enough and deeply enough, you'll find out that most of the great ideas of life came out of very particular human circumstances. That point in time, primarily as a youngster, when you learned that what you knew to be a personal truth was not a truth that was respected in the structures around you. And you have to try to make sense out of what seems so clear to a child and what has been structured otherwise. So that happened to me. I can remember I was in sixth grade. It was a common experience in a Catholic school. One day, Sister announced that anybody who wanted to be an altar boy should stay after school and go to such and such a classroom where the training would begin. Now, the fact of the matter is that I had a cousin, 1 year younger than I, a bright and wonderful young boy, whom I loved very much. I had seen Eddie, and he did it so well. And I went to daily mass, and I saw it done every day. And I decided, as a young girl, about 10 or 11 years old, that the closer I could be to that altar, the better it would be. The more spiritual I would be able to become. I showed up in the classroom that night. It was so logical. Everything about it was right. It never crossed my mind that all those pieces didn't go together. My family did it. The church needed servers. This was a holy thing to do, and I wanted to do it. So for 1 year, working with Eddie, I had studied and learned all of the responses. I knew all of the Latin. Eddie and I said it together all the time. I was ready. So that night I walked into the classroom. There were boys. When I look back now, there must have been 15 or 20 boys sitting in the room. And I took my place. I was the only girl. That it didn't bother me. It never crossed my mind there was anything incongruous about that. And Sister came in, and she looked around the room, and she said, "And what do you want? What are you doing here, Joan?" And I said, "Well, Sister, I came to be an altar boy." Now imagine, the language didn't even strike. Never occurred to me, because they'd always told me that when they said men, they meant me. So what what was wrong with being an altar boy? And she said, Joan, girls aren't altar boys. Boys are. Please leave.
Mm.
And I can remember, Celeste, and I say in the book, all the boys began to hoot and laugh. And I remember that they hooted and laughed all the way from the far side of that classroom over to the door. And I can remember that laugh to this day. It was a little girl's confrontation with a church structure that said God didn't want girls.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much the girls wanted God, no matter how much the girls wanted church, God and the church did not want girls. Not in the heart of them. They wanted them serving them, perhaps. You know, they wanted them fixing the flowers and setting up the candles. But they didn't want girls in anything that approached the sacramental. It was a blow that was submerged for years mm. and years, but never forgotten.
Yeah. You know, that is just so unjust and not right and unfair.
Well, if you're a girl, Celeste, you have to ask you start asking at the age of 10 and 11, why?
Mm.
What's not good enough about me? And every time they teach that God made human beings, men and women, in God's own image, the little girl has to do one of two things. She has to say, well, not me, not really, not the full image. Or she comes to another conclusion that says, yes, I know that. Yes, I am. And God is in me as much as in anybody else. But they won't admit it. So this little girl is always, always in tension with the deepest part of her, which is her spiritual part.
So in that circumstance, how do you keep your faith and how do you keep faith with the church?
Well, you come to the point where you make a distinction between those two. You do keep the faith. There's nothing wrong with the faith. You watch Jesus move among women. You watch Jesus take in all the outcasts so that you know that in Jesus' presence there are no outcasts. Where Jesus is, no rules, no boundaries, national, religious, or political count. Not the tax collectors aren't out. The Roman soldiers aren't out. The women aren't out. The lepers aren't out. Where Jesus is, everybody is, and everybody is on equal footing. Then you discover that Jesus that Jesus is presented to the world, usually, through very human institutions, through vehicles called religion. And you have to make a distinction in your life between what is the faith and how far the whole church has come in the recognition and the implementation of that faith. Now, the human dimension of the church, we know that the church is sinful because we are the church and we're all sinners. So we're all in the process of trying to come to the fullness of Jesus. That's what I count on. That's what I trust, that over time, as a church, we will all recognize what the faith demands. It's when those two things become synonyms that you would have to leave the church. And, otherwise, you stay in the church in order to be what part of a church that's growing and that's being converted and that is becoming more than its least spiritual self.
Hmm. Did you choose sisterhood or did it choose you?
Ah, that's a great question. Do you want that story? I mean, that's a story.
I'd love to hear it.
Well, my father died when I was 3. And I was an only child. My mother wasn't, however. My mother was the youngest of 13. And the family was very, very concerned about the fact that my mother made the remark that we, meaning she and I, would be at the funeral parlor by such and such a time. And her brothers and sisters said to her, "We? You're certainly not bringing the baby. You're not bringing Joan." My mother said, "Of course I am." They said, "You cannot bring Joan to a funeral parlor." My mother said, "Are you out of your mind? Joan's father died. It wasn't just my husband that died. Joan's father died." Now, my father died when he was 23. My mother was a 21-year-old widow with a 3-year-old baby. And this young woman said, "This death is as important in her life as it is in mine. And she has to come to grips with it, just the way we all do. If I don't take her to that funeral parlor, what is she to think? She will simply think that her daddy left her. I don't want that." So sure enough, this young, strong woman took me into that funeral parlor, picked me up in her arms so that I could see into the coffin, and began to talk to me about daddy had gone to heaven. Now, sitting down at the end of the coffin, I remember as clearly as if it were yesterday, were what I know now, or came to understand later, were two Sisters of Mercy, because my father had been taught by the Sisters of Mercy in the local Catholic high school in the area. And I had never seen such things. Now, just remember what I'm talking about when I'm talking about a Sister of Mercy in that period. I had no idea what this was. And I said to her, with my arms around her neck, "Mommy, what are those?" And pointed to them. And my mother's answer was, "Honey, those are sisters. And they are very special friends of God's, and they're very special friends of Daddy's. And when the angels come tonight to take Daddy's soul, the sisters will be here and they'll say, 'Now, this is Joan's daddy. He was a very good daddy, and he loved God very much, so please take him straight to God.'" Now, Celeste, as simple as that may seem to you, if you're 3 years old, I couldn't think of a better job in the whole world than to take little girls' daddy's souls to God. And I made up my mind at that point, that I would be a sister, and I would do that too. Mm. So I spent the rest of my life chasing nuns down streets, trying to get a look at them and see what they were all about.
Yeah.
And then I went to a Catholic school, and I must admit I loved them. And then I went to a Catholic high school, and I was even more impressed. They were strong, wonderful, happy, laughing women. They were good with us kids and good with one another. And I knew that's where I was supposed to be. Mm. That's where I would go. So it's a lifelong story. Mm. It didn't come suddenly. It came very young, very slowly, and it never wavered. So I'm not really sure whether I got it or it got me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Kind of a coming together.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was talk about an epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that if something happened to anybody at that young age, that someplace along the line, that would be contested for that very reason. Or that when you came into contact with the reality of it, you would say, "Well, it's not this, it's this, and I don't want it." And even though I was very clear-eyed about that all my life, and smiled to myself about the original story, nevertheless, Celeste, my admiration for them and for the life never abated.
Hmm. The question I posed at the outset in my introduction, can you be a good feminist and a good Christian? Your answer is, of course, yes. Talk with us, though, about that. How do these two things come together?
Well, the first thing that people have to do is understand that feminism and female, I'm very, very strong about this, very clear about this in the book. I spend almost a chapter on it. Feminism and female, or feminist and female, are not synonyms. Feminists come in two genders, both male and female. And there are a number of females who are not feminists, who have internalized the message of their own inferiority. And they're very, very threatened by women who talk otherwise, because they don't have a sense of themselves as being independent, competent, full of God. So they can't imagine that any other woman could be either. Now, if you see feminism then not as some sort of female political platform, but a worldview, a set of values that that affect the way we live life, then you realize that the question you have to ask yourself is, then what are the feminist values, as opposed to those values that are based on the patriarchal concept of a dominant gender, a dominant male gender. And any time that you assume that a culture or any society is based on dominance, well, then you have to ask, dominant in what, and dominant through what? And that takes you, of course, to the glorification of the rational, to the expectation of power, to the uses, the development of strategies to get and keep power, to the internalization of a sense of superiority that leads to pride, to a notion that one gender speaks for and controls the other gender. And that, of course, can break down into a very competitive society. The feminist says, look what that's done. And is that Christian? And then you look at Jesus, and you look at the Jesus story, and you look at the Judeo-Christian scriptures, and you say, but we have a God full of feeling. We have a God and a Christ figure who empowered everyone. We have a Jesus who was committed to nonviolence, who didn't raise a finger to subdue his enemies, who was full of humility, who recognized the value in all other people around him, who was full of compassion, and who was very vulnerable. Those are basic, fundamental Christian values. Question. Can a good feminist be a good Christian? Answer. How can you be anything but? How can you be a Christian and not be a feminist? That's the major philosophical, theological question. And it's the fundamental question. It's the only ultimate question to ask. Now, if you see femaleness, if you see feminism as simply a new kind of female chauvinism designed to somehow or other overthrow male chauvinism, in the first place, I don't think you can find any theological scriptural foundation for that. And in the second place, what do you have except female? You have the patriarchal values in the female, absorbed by the female. That's not feminism. No real feminist would really espouse those qualities. So, to me, it's quite obvious. The values that I was taught as being basic to the Christian spiritual life are the values that are basic to feminist philosophy and a feminist view of life, and therefore I see the two. One needs the other. One implies the other.
Mm. Now, feminism is a word that turns a lot of folks off or frightens them. Mm-hmm. Some would blame feminism see feminism as a threat, for example, to the family. How do you respond?
Well, there are two comments or two arenas implied in that question, Celeste, so I want to look at them one at a time.
Okay.
You're quite right. Well, in almost every audience, someone will say, well, you know, I really agree with you. I don't disagree with anything that you're saying here. I think it's really important. But don't you think it would be better if we found another word and not use the word feminism? Because, well, just people just get so upset by it. And my answer to that is always the same. Don't you understand what you're saying? You are saying that the female and anything a woman thinks or presents the world is so unacceptable that when we use the word feminism, people cringe. The measure of the cringing is the measure of the sexism. If you can't even accept the word feminism, it tells me instantly how you devalue women. We may not like, for instance, we may not approve of everything we hear of in the philosophy of existentialism, but we don't change the word. We may not think that everything that we know about classicism or romanticism is applicable now, but we don't require people to change the word so somebody will study it or think about it or involve it in their lives. So, as long as feminism stays a dirty word, it's the very proof we have of how women are devalued in this society. They can't possibly think anything of quality. To part two of your question.
Mm-hmm.
Do we fear feminism because of its attack on the family? That's a red herring argument. People use it all the time. You know, marriage would be wonderful if it weren't for feminism. And I argue that marriage has always been what it is right now, and the only difference is that women aren't taking it any longer. That women are coming to a sense of self that requires that marriage be what it's supposed to be, and that is a partnership of equals. A friendship covenant, a bonding of human beings. It's time for us to stop talking about mothering and begin to talk about parenting. Feminism doesn't weaken the family. Feminism strengthens the family if it's treated objectively. And with great understanding. You weaken a family if you take one person's life and make that person responsible for facilitating everybody else's convenience. You know, we know now, demographically, for instance, that a woman now in this culture is about 40 years old when her last child leaves the home. That means that women have anywhere from 35 to 45 more years to live. And if they haven't been developing as human beings, as full adults, all the time that their children was developing and their husband was developing, what's left for them? Then we stand around and say, my God, she got mean, or sour, or negative, or witchy. Oh, God, she's impossible. You can't talk to her about anything. All she does is nag or whine. If that woman is not developing as a rich, thoughtful, exciting personality, she knows that. He knows that. He comes home and stops talking to her. Because she doesn't have any ideas to talk about. And he's been out there in the world of ideas. So he comes home, hides behind his paper, sits on the couch, opens another bottle of beer, turns on the television. She talks at him and he says, mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. Nothing is better for the family than that both the man and the woman have the opportunity to become full human beings. Now, in order to do that, that means they are going to have to go about the structuring of that family differently than the homes in which most of us grew up. He's going to have to stop at the drugstore. He's going to have to go shopping. He's going to have to cook a couple nights a week while she's out at class or teaching, or in a study group or in the book club. They're going to have to really now do this marriage and this home together.
Our guest this afternoon is Sister Joan Chittister, and we're talking with her this afternoon about feminism and spirituality. Sister Joan is a member of the Benedictine Sisters of Erie. She will be in Champaign-Urbana 1 week from Saturday to take part in a Baker Board event at the Wesley Foundation. Well, she'll be talking about this very topic of feminist spirituality for women and men. If you'd like more information on this upcoming event, here's a number to call, 344-1120, the area code 217. This is a Baker Board event, and it is Saturday, November 6th from 12:30 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Wesley Foundation. If you'd like more information, if you'd like to attend this, pre-registration is advised. The telephone number again, 217-344-1120. If you'd like to talk with Sister Joan Chittister this afternoon, join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you're listening, 1-800-222-9455. And we have a couple of callers waiting to talk with us this afternoon. We're going to go first to Bloomington, Indiana, a caller on line one. Hello.
Hi. I would like to agree that true Christianity elevates the status of women. Women were certainly hardly better viewed as better than animals until Jesus elevated their status. It was a woman who Jesus first encountered after his resurrection. That privilege was given to a woman, and that privilege also was given to a woman to go tell the rest of the disciples of his resurrection. However, no feminists can claim a Christian value when they devalue motherhood, and when they advocate no-fault divorce, and when they advocate abortion. Legalized abortion, you see, places upon a totally innocent unborn baby the obligation to die for the convenience of a woman. What could be more immoral, unchristian, than requiring one person to die for the benefit of another?
Is there a question there?
I think I just asked a question. What could be more immoral than requiring one person to die for the benefit of another, because he's inconvenient?
I couldn't agree more. I have no problem with that statement whatsoever. I think that the statement, however, generalizes to such a degree that this becomes the undiscussable topic, and I wish we wouldn't do that. For instance, if I took out the word abortion and said, what could be more, whatever you said, unchristian
immoral?
I don't remember.
Immoral?
Immoral. What could be more immoral than requiring one person to die in order to satisfy our sense of vengeance, and we call it capital punishment? What could be more immoral than requiring a person to die and in order to make us feel secure? So we send an 18-year-old kid down a 30-story silo to wait for the green light to come on so we can destroy half the world. The question is not who does or doesn't approve of abortion. I'm sure there are some people that approve heartily. On the other hand, that's not what the polls are saying. I think that the question is not who supports abortion. I haven't been able to find anybody who does. But the question is, what is life? We're hung up on the question of when is life life. I wish we would really do one of two things. Either not allow any exceptions whatsoever to the question of human life, that the taking of any life under any circumstance is always immoral, or we must put our energies into deciding what life is And all I can tell you is I haven't been able to find anybody who knows that anymore either. The day that they announced the cloning of Dolly the sheep, the definition of life became iffier than it's ever been in the history of humankind. And when they get to the cloning of human beings or this woolly mammoth that they're going to try to bring back, we have such major questions. This whole notion of throwing the terminology immoral on anybody at any time might itself be immoral. We've got to sit down as human beings and understand that we are at a crossover moment in time that is unlike anything in our past and is leading us to a completely different future. This is no time to try to solve that question by demonizing anybody. Let's sit down and try to come to some consensus about all of this. When life begins at this end and when life ends at that end. We have the same question with euthanasia as we have with abortion. We have the same question with nuclear weapons as we have with abortion. Isn't it interesting that when life is in the hands of men, thousands of lives at one time, actually all life on the planet at one time, with the nuclear weapons that they say they have designed to defend us, that seems to be morally acceptable. We call it at least a matter of theological doubt. But when a woman finds herself in a position, not necessarily for reasons of convenience, that in itself is a generalization that demonizes women in general. I don't know why women have abortions, all of them, but I'm convinced it's not convenience any more than bombing 200,000 Iraqi troops running for their mother's kitchens was a matter of convenience. So I recognize the question. I respect the question, but I find the question limiting and beneath us as reflective spiritual people.
Am I still on?
Yeah, you want to make a follow-up comment, and then I do want to go to another caller because we've got...
Sure.
Your guest made two arguments. She argued against capital punishment, and she argued against killing other people in national defense. Let me state something about capital punishment. The difference between an innocent baby and somebody being executed is guilt. We don't execute people who are innocent.
Sir, excuse me for interrupting. I don't want to do that to you, and I'm not. I want you to understand that the government itself has indicated that one out of every seven of our executions are of an innocent person. We have released more people from death row who have been there for years on the basis of DNA evidence in the last 2.5 years than have ever been released. And simply extrapolating that material itself tells us that one out of every seven times we're wrong. So I'm sorry, but we simply cannot use innocence as the reason to be absolute in this question of what is life.
Mm. And let me just, for the caller's benefit, raise the issue with you about defense.
Yes.
What is the role of isn't it moral to defend one's country? Or
it
can it be?
It certainly is. Yeah. But I would argue that it is immoral to jeopardize the life of the entire globe in doing it.
Let's talk with another caller. This one on line 2 in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd just like to say a hearty amen. I mean a person to what you just said. It seems to me from what you've been saying that it almost is easier to be a Christian outside the framework of an institution which tends to reinforce very, very traditional roles through guilt and shame and power than to try to, to me it would seem, that to struggle anew with the fact that institutions are very unhelpful a lot of times, and maybe new forms are needed.
Well, I hear this a lot, and I understand the feeling when people get put into into boxes that are very destructive of them as individuals. And I know that there are moments in life when the most spiritual thing a person can do is distance themselves from destructive institutions of whatever nature. At the same time, I don't want to argue against the institution. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in one. Mm-hmm. I do see the institution as the keeper of the flame, the depository of spiritual treasures, the call, the flag to all of us to think through these questions, to raise the moral issues, to sensitize us to what to the pitfalls that we may be facing technologically, to tell us over and over again, just because we can do a thing, doesn't technologically, scientifically, doesn't mean that we ought to do it. And so, I value and I reverence and I honor the institution as that laser beam of concentration that concentrates us on the Jesus in our midst and the God, the living God who created us. I'll always honor that. And the keeping of the tradition for us so that we can all grow together. At the same time, there is no doubt in my mind personally that the institution, I hear it from women all the time, the institution is a terrible stumbling block when the institution moralizes for both men and women, but sees only men as full spiritual figures. Those are really difficult moments, and institutions have to be dealt with on the personal level, and we have to ask ourselves whether or not what is happening to me in this institution and at this time. You know, Thomas Aquinas said, if we ever found ourselves in a position where the church itself was a hindrance to our salvation, that conscience supersedes that, we would be obliged to leave the church in order to maintain our consciences. I'm convinced that happens. I see it happening, especially in women who believe that their God is bigger and closer to them than the institution itself is communicating at the present time. That doesn't mean that the institution itself isn't good. It just means that the institution is struggling too. These aren't personal questions that we're in, you know?
Yes.
These are crossover questions at one of the most difficult moments that human history has ever known. I also want to end that response by saying there are a lot of mightily spiritual and wonderful people in this world who have nothing to do with the institution, mm-hmm. and they are lights and models to us all, and I respect them deeply.
May I ask a follow-up, please?
Sure.
Sure.
Do you think, for instance, that the Catholic Church is really capable of reform?
Yes, I do, and I'll tell you why. It always has. Now, it comes along late. Mm-hmm. I mean, realize that after the Reformation, we have 400 years of resistance. And then in Vatican II, if you study Vatican II very carefully, you will find out that every single thing the reformers asked for, Vatican II affirmed. It's painful, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not trying to justify the 400-year lapse. The notion that, as we have always taught, works while you make martyrs of the people who have really raised the essential questions. But if I answer your question at the level at which I think you're asking it with such sincerity, is the church capable of conversion? I mean, I think history shows us yes. There's no question about that. We've come from the Crusades and the Inquisition to a real struggle, for instance, over the questions of peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Catholic Church who set up the first rules for war. It was the Catholic Church who did some of the major mediating of the Middle Ages. So we have a mixed history.
Yeah.
We're an old church We've had the chance to sin a lot. At the same time, the church has slowly and painfully, throughout time, I think, tried to address most of these questions. My personal great hope is that the Holy Spirit alive in the church will continue to convert us.
Thank you for your honesty and openness.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're here right at the, we've got like a minute or two left in this portion of the program, the time that we can spend together today. And I want to ask this question because we've sort of talked around it a bit, but we haven't really hit it on the head, so to speak. And that is, you know, just what is the role of spirituality in Christian life?
Well, the role of spirituality, to be as brief as I can, is to magnetize and to develop that finest part of the human being, that center of our souls, which is magnetized by and therefore searches for something greater than the mundane. Spirituality is what keeps us in touch with the universe, and that reminds us that we are more than we seem, that we have about us the stuff of glory, and that that we don't have to succumb to our worst selves. And when we succumb to our worst selves, that self that is destructive of others, that is destructive of the self, that is centered in the self, when we succumb to that, we have forfeited our full humanity. Spirituality is the call that beckons us to our best selves.
Mm. It's a call to action?
Always. It's not a call to a spiritual jacuzzi. And we turn it into that, but that's not spirituality. That's pietism. That's using prayer and religion to make me feel good. That's wanting God as some sort of a safety net and a winter and a woolen blanket. You know, pietism wants me. It's kind of a religious insurance policy. Here are the things you do to be good. I did them, therefore I get the golden ring. Spirituality says we're always in search. We walk with the God who made us and who is within us as well as in everybody around us, and we are always, always, always becoming more. Because God is everything. I can always become more.
Sister Joan, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. You've been quite gentle and quite beautiful to talk to. Thank you very much.
Well, we look forward to seeing you in Champaign-Urbana 1 week from Saturday.
Good, because I'm coming, ready or not.
Okay.
Goodbye, Celeste.
Take care.
Thank you.
Sister Joan Chittister has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is a member of the Benedictine Sisters of Erie. She's the author of many books, including Heart of Flesh, A Feminist Spirituality for Women and Men.